Hello, and welcome to Speaking Volumes, the radio book group for everyone who enjoys reading and talking about books. We are a production of Audio Journal. This program is funded in part by the Greater Worcester Community Foundation and by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome, and if you're one of our regular members, welcome back. Audio Journal is a radio reading service intended for a print-impaired audience. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goals of informing and entertaining. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, or staff. The opinions are ours alone, and there are six of us gathered around the table in the studio tonight. I'd like to welcome Susan Ropsky, Steve Ropsky, Stacy Lanier, Peter Welsh, and Carla McCullough. My name is Carol Sarafkhan. Tonight, we're discussing the author, Louise Penny. We hope you'll join the conversation. The phone number to call, 508-373-2343. I'll repeat that again, 508-373-2343. Feel free to jump in with a phone call anytime. We don't mind being interrupted. I'm going to begin by telling you a little bit about our author of the night, Louise Penny. Louise Penny is a Canadian author of mystery novels set in the Canadian province of Quebec, centered on the work of Francophone Chief Inspector Armand Gamache of the Sûreté de Québec. Penny's first career was as a radio broadcaster for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. After she turned to writing, she won numerous awards for her work, including the Agatha Award for Best Mystery Novel of the Year 5 times and the Anthony Award for Best Novel of the Year 5 times. Her novels have been published in 23 languages. Her work features Chief Inspector Armand Gamache, head of the Homicide Department of the Sûreté de Québec. The novels are set in and around the small village of Three Pines, near the Vermont border. They feature many hallmarks of the British whodunit genre, including murders by unconventional means, bucolic villages, large cast of suspects, red herrings, and a dramatic disclosure of the murderer in the last few pages. Well, I want to start by going around our circle here, just your general impression of Louise Penny, and then we'll talk more specific. Peter, why don't you start us off?
Hello. This was my first Louise Penny book. I read Still Life. Fascinating. I was only 10 pages into it, and I really liked her style. Easy to follow, but lots of different characters, lots of different character agendas, and I will definitely read more.
And
interestingly, my aunt and uncle live in Knowlton, Quebec, which is where Louise Penny lives, and my aunt was actually a broadcaster for CBC as well.
Oh, you have all kinds of connections then. Carla, what are your thoughts?
I am a new Louise Penny super fan, having read one book already. I chose The Long Way Home, which is book 10 in this series of approximately 20 or so, I believe, now. It will not be my last. I hope to go back to the beginning and travel along with Armand through his adventures. I really enjoyed the book a lot.
Now, Stacy, I know you're a longtime fan. What are your thoughts?
That's right. Well, I love to read a series, for one thing, and I love her series in particular because, the characters are just so unusual and yet so believable. And I have enjoyed seeing the character development, the relationships change and develop over the course of the books. I love the familiarity of it. It just, I think Carla said a cozy mystery. That's exactly what these are.
So I had read a few
Louise Penny books in the past, and I went back and I read Still Life, which is her first, mm-hmm. and I read Grey Wolf, which is her latest. I'm not a super fan. I enjoyed them. I kind of enjoyed them, and I agree they have elements of the cozy mystery. They also have elements, I think, of like a gothic, where they have, I mean, a number of her books have like the creepy house on the hill, mm-hmm. and that kind of, you know, people hiding in rooms and kind of popping out at you kind of things. I felt like she kind of goes over the top with Armand. I like him, but she almost makes him sort of godlike. And I felt like I was being beaten over the head with what a great guy he was. And it got a little tiresome. But I got a kick out of her characters, the characters in Three Pines. And I read some reviews where people complained that she talked too much about food. And for me, you can't talk too much about food, you know, describing the French pastries. It's like, yeah, keep going. That's fine. So I like them, but I don't crazy love them.
Okay. And Steve?
First time reader. I read the first one, Still Life, and the latest one, Grey Wolf, just to see how she developed. I could see that she would be a very good beach read, mm-hmm. particularly on a hot, sunny day reading about Quebec. the first book, I felt like they were highlighting the red herrings. I felt like every time she put down something that wasn't quite, helpful, she kind of winked while she did it. The evil husband. I can't think of his name.
Peter.
I know you're Peter.
Peter and Clara.
Okay, right. Yes, thank you. so I wasn't particularly impressed with the first one.
Or Yolanda's husband as well.
Yolanda's husband. Right. Who I was thinking of. Thank you. Yeah. I couldn't think of Yolanda either. Right. It seemed very much like Crab Apple Cove, Murder, She Wrote, mm-hmm. and all the English elements mm-hmm. there and all of that. So I wasn't crazy about it. I read her penultimate, I believe it's the penultimate, Grey Wolf, and it seemed to drag. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, about halfway through, it picked up, and stuff started happening. I never learned French, strange as it seems, living this close to Quebec. You know, I have a little bit. And the fact that most of the names and most of the places were in French, brought back a feeling I had many years ago when I had to go to Montreal on business and I was driving and I could not find my way back because I couldn't read the street signs as I drove by. I could not say, okay, that's Fred Street and that's Sugar Street or whatever. And it's kind of a strange feeling to be someplace where you can't read. So when I do this frequently. So it really touched me in there. Mm-hmm. It certainly felt like Montreal to me. Mm-hmm. I've been there several times on business now. Sue keeps saying, let's go for fun. I said, why?
Well, I was affected by the enthusiasm that Stacy and Tricia, who couldn't be here tonight, have for these novels. So mm-hmm. I started with one, and I've read six already.
All right.
because I really do like it, and I've heard a little bit about, learned a little bit more about the author, and you might be interested, Susan, to know that after she started writing her books, on reflection, she realized that Armand Gamache was her husband. That she didn't mean to, but she, as she was describing him and what his characteristics were. Love him.
Yes.
She does love him. And, but I think that it's a successful series in that Gamache is a likable character that you don't mind that he's going to be in the next book and the next book mm-hmm. and a character that you like and respect his methods. He's not a brutal, he's not a bully, you know, mm-hmm. you're not going to be impressed mm-hmm. by his interrogation techniques, which, you know, you might in another series, but his thoughtful approach to doing things. So I liked the characters that she's done. Mm-hmm. I love reading about flaky croissants and crispy baguettes and oh my goodness.
The fresh butter and jam.
Yeah. And I'm a rusty, but I'm a French speaker. I studied that all the way through school, and so I love the little French elements that are in it. I can see that that could be very irritating to somebody else, but to me, that's a plus.
No, it wasn't irritating at all.
Oh, it wasn't irritating.
As I said, it reinstated this sense that I'd had, the sense of mystery of being lost.
No.
One thing, I saw that somewhere someone asked her in an interview if you needed to read the books in order, and she said, oh, no, each one stands on its own, which is kind of true. But if you're going to read more than one, you really should read them in order, because I had read, what was it, Beautiful Mystery, I think. And then I went back when Steve started and read Still Life, and I already knew who the murderer had to be because I knew which characters were going to show up in the next book, you know, and it's like, well, it can't be you because... You know, you could carry on through the rest of the books, so you really kind of need to read them in sequence. Otherwise, a whole lot gets given away.
Yeah. So, Stacy, will you tell us about your experience last summer?
Oh, yes. Last summer, I went with my sister to Knowlton, and we did a Louise Penny tour.
Okay.
It was a day-long tour, just a small group with a very experienced and just delightful tour guide. And we went to many of the places on which she has based places in the book. Mm-hmm. So we went to the bakery. We went to the bookstore. We went to the church. We
Is there
went
a pond?
To the inn.
Is there a pond?
No, there is a lovely stream, though, that goes... That goes through it. And Knowlton is much bigger than Three Pines. So she's, she's sort of taken all these other different places from around in the area and brought them together in her books. So that was a wonderful experience.
Fun. And did you eat any flaky croissants or crusty baguettes?
We ate our way through this tour. We ate at every place that had something to eat. The bakery, the little, we're just a little lunch place. We went to a lovely inn for lunch, for a meal. Yeah, so it was really delightful. So if you
delightful and delicious,
yeah,
it
delightful
sounds like.
And yeah. Delicious, very relaxing.
Well, one of my favorite foods when I'm in Quebec is they call it poutine.
Poutine.
Oh
French
gosh,
Canadian
yeah, real poutine. Yeah.
I don't.
So
think
I always pick out on that.
I don't think I remember reading about poutine in any of her books.
I think it was mentioned in one of them. Mm-hmm. I think it was probably The Grey Wolf, just some reference to poutine.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right, yeah.
You know, it sounds appalling.
Oh, it's delicious.
Yes, I've had it.
We've had it. Yeah, they sell it at some of the fast food places, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right
even
along
McDonald's
the border.
Had it for a while.
Yeah?
But,
yeah. Well,
you know, I was thinking, Sue and Steve, that you... you mentioned some ambivalence about the books, having read the first and the latest. And actually, as I went back and read about them, those are the two that get the least glowing reviews.
I can see.
So you might want to go for one in the middle.
I will look. I was thinking I'm going to look for like two and three and just see if I, you know, if I do get caught up. I don't think I've read. Read The Beautiful Mystery. That takes place at a monastery. Mm. And there was another I couldn't remember the name of. But.
Yeah, I think The Grey Wolf was my least favorite because, well, for two reasons. One is that there are just a ton of characters, and I could not keep track of who was who. But the other reason is it wasn't set in Three Pines. Very much at all.
Right.
And I just missed all those characters. I just missed Ruth and her duck and Clara and Myrna. So, yeah.
I was trying to figure out how they got marshmallows stuck to the ceiling.
Yes. That was a delightful and almost realistic what children will do.
Mm-hmm. Carla, yeah. you described it as a cozy mystery, and I heard an interview with Louise Penny. I listened to one of these audio, and I know, Peter, you said your wife listens to the audio version. The narrator is fantastic. Mm-hmm. His French is great, too. So he says all of those with just the right accent. But there was a little interview at the end, kind of a bonus, and she said something about your books have been described as cozy mysteries. And are they cozy mysteries? And Louise Penny said no. Oh, right goodness. Away. She said, you could read them that way because they, you know, they do have the aspects of the village mystery, which is another description of those things. But she said, I hope that each book also explores something else on a deeper level. And so I was wondering, as we've all read different books here, if in the book that you read, did you see something that she might have been exploring on a little bit deeper level than whodunit?
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure. I think it was Still Life where she deals with the young boy being or thinking he is a homosexual and striking out at everyone and in the anger because he's, you know, he's just confused and
believe.
He's just...
Believe?
I believe so, yeah. Just because... Just the anger because he doesn't know how to deal. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was just a nice thing to add in there. It fleshed out the book or it fleshed out the character. It wasn't really important to the story itself.
And it came out kind of at the end that Yolanda's son had been blackmailing him.
Yes, yes.
So it was a lot of intrigue.
Yeah, yeah. And there was... I think there's quite a bit about addiction and stuff, like with Jean-Guy. And I think that probably goes through a lot of the stories.
Yes, so the one of the ones that I reread for this, I have to look and see what it was. Kingdom of the Blind. It was, there were like two parallel stories, and one of them was about addiction and, yes, and its effect on the community. So that was interesting, but it also, I thought, really explored issues of loyalty, family connections and what they mean and what they don't mean. I think that's true, that there's always something deeper, and I always learned something. Mm-hmm. That I didn't know. So this one had an element of dealing with the financial world. And I learned some things.
And I think this is from watching the Three Pines TV program. Oh. I assume it came from a book. But dealing with the Indian boarding schools. Mm-hmm. Was there a book that talked about that?
Not that I've read yet.
I don't
I think maybe because, like... I'm on book 10 here, having not read any of the books prior to that. Did stand alone, but like you said, it will be worthwhile to go back. And he did mention, he referenced some of those remote sites having been to. So I'm wondering if perhaps, indigenous people and how he did solve some crime with the indigenous people and how remote they were. So perhaps, yes, prior to 10. Less than 10, but greater than 1. So.
Carla, what about in the book you read? Did you notice any underlying...
I'm wondering, is it okay if I read a passage
that's
going to answer that question? But also, I highlighted this because only on page 24 is where she hooked me with, oh, I love the way you write. So I wanted just...
Good.
That's okay if I read this paragraph. I say that, and yet did I remember my reading glasses? No. So this is when Armand's wife and daughter were sitting out on their front porch, and it says, the moth still fluttered around the light, butting and bumping against the bulb. Was it warmth it wanted? Rainmarie wondered. Was it light the moth sought? Does it hurt? Rainmarie wondered. The singeing of the wings, the little legs like threads landing on the white-hot glass, then pushing away. Does it hurt that the light doesn't give the moth what it so desperately desires? She got up and turned the porch light off, and after a few moments, the beating of the wings stopped, and Rain Marie returned to her peaceful seat. It was quiet now and dark, except for the buttery light from the sitting room window. As the silence grew, Rain Marie wondered if she'd done the moth a favor. Had she saved its life but taken away its purpose? And then the beating started again, flitting, desperate, tiny, delicate, insistent. The moth had moved down the porch. Now it was beating against the window of the room where Armand and Jean Guy sat. It had found its light. It would never give up. It couldn't. Rain Marie got up, watched by her daughter, and turned the porch light back on. It was the moth's nature to do what it was doing, and Rain Marie could not stop it, no matter how much she might want to. And this is all metaphor for how her husband, now retired, was getting pulled back into solving another mystery, and she did not want him getting pulled back out of retirement. And I said, chef's kiss, that was beautiful. I just loved that metaphor. So that was my answer. Yes, just dealing with, you know, this is where our life is now, and you need to go back. There's a compulsion to go back, even though you're retired. So, yeah, just life roles, I thought it explored nicely.
I'm a newbie at this, so I've read the first novel, you know, Still Life, but several of the characters, and particularly the police, you know, it was, Gamache was fairly easy to understand. Beauvoir, on the other hand, I didn't really understand him as much. And Nicole was very, just kind of unsettled, even though she wasn't necessarily wrong all the time, but her missteps. And then it was unresolved as to, did she go back on the bus back to Montreal? Because later on, she hasn't taken the bus yet, so then that you don't hear anything about her, but I thought the individual character development for each of them was fascinating. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. The other thing I thought was the diverse economic situation of these people, these townspeople, because some, you know, like Peter and Clara, barely have two nickels to rub together, mm-hmm. And Ben, I guess, came from a family of money, mm-hmm. and you don't really know what Ruth's status is, much less Myrna's, mm-hmm. you know, and others. So it's just a mixed economic bag, too. Yet they're all friends, or at least thought they were. So.
A couple things that I've noticed, because I've read several close together, I don't have to wait a year for the next one to come out, I noticed that there is often a new recruit or a new person who joins the team, and it gives Gamache someone to explain his methods to. And that person might be in a couple of books and then go someplace else, or they might just be in one book. But I think that's a strategy that she uses to always have somebody that he's explaining mm-hmm. things to. And it's effective, you know. Mm-hmm. Also, I think themes that I see through several books are often about belonging and loyalty and what happens if you have competing loyalties to family and friends or to employers and family, you know, and that kind of thing. I think we can kind of generalize that goes through a lot of her books. I really think it's interesting. I read something about, you know, why are mysteries so appealing as a genre? And they are, you know, I know in our little town library, well, there's the mystery room and then there are all the rest of the books over there. And, you know, there's something about knowing that it's going to be resolved at the end.
Yes.
You know, that you'll invest yourself in this, but you know it's going to tie up in the end. Some mysteries are quite sensational and graphic in the gore of the of the murder. Hers are not like that. Often it even almost happens off stage, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
And even when they describe examining the corpse or something. It's, she doesn't give us a lot of blood and guts, you know. Mm. It's more about, exploring the emotions and the personalities that might have combined in a toxic way to cause somebody to do this crazy thing.
In this book was 368 pages. The murder did not occur until page 343. Can you imagine? And I didn't mind. I'm like, you'll get there when you get there. I'm happy to come along with all this. And it was certainly mystery, but we didn't know if there was even a crime, if there was a dead body or not, until 20 pages to go. Isn't that crazy? Well, yeah.
Yeah,
it is something. Oh, I hope I didn't give anything away from when you get to this.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah, in still life, it happened before the story started.
Oh, mm-hmm. There you go. How interesting.
I really like her emphasis on the community mm-hmm. of people of Three Pines and their developing relationships and how they joke with each other and really poke fun at each other in ways that, you know, would be offensive if they were not good friends.
Right.
And the way that they're sort of in and out of each other's life, in this one, it references the crystal pitcher that Ruth took from the bistro a few months ago, and she's always got obnoxious nicknames for people. She might be one of my favorite characters.
I was going to ask people about Ruth because I'm sure she was in every book. She was in your right.
She was.
She's okay. I understand why the new recruit is there, what purpose the new recruit serves for Gamache to explain his method, but what does Ruth serve? What's her purpose here?
In the book that I listened to, I felt like Ruth is in some ways the truth teller.
Mm-hmm.
That she just, and maybe not directly, but I think she often has insight that others do not have. And maybe she says it in a way that makes her seem like a crackpot. But I see her as, I don't know what that, the person standing kind of outside of things, and telling the truth.
Is it like the court jester who says things no one else would say?
Mm-hmm.
That's
that,
a nice
that might be it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wasn't she at Ruth's bathroom? Was the one with that inscription on the mirror? Nicole had to go up and use the facility, and she saw that on there, and that was kind of telling.
Yeah, what was it? Because Nicole didn't get it, right?
Well, she read it, but I don't think she knew enough about Ruth to understand it. But it was about what you see is. I don't know. I don't want to guess what it was, but it was cryptic, but understandable, knowing what we know of Ruth from the book.
Mm. And so here we have this person who appears like the town crackpot, mm-hmm. Who tells the truth, but maybe it comes across as an insult or something like that. And yet, she's a poet of national renown.
Yes.
It's hard for me to put those two together.
Yeah.
Well, I think it is. I think her poetry has that element of insightfulness mm-hmm. into human nature and people's character. So I think that's the same as what happens with her truth-telling.
Mm-hmm. You can learn a lot about Quebec history in these books. I think the author must have a real love for Quebec, clearly, but for the history of Quebec, because when you talk about learning things, I'm learning all about the founders of Quebec and different battles that were fought there. And
this book had a real art focus, and they were mentioning this famous artist from Quebec, and I googled, and legit author and with gorgeous landscapes of Quebec. So I said, oh, I'm getting art history. I'm getting Quebec history. It was very enjoyable. My horizons were effectively broadened after reading it. So, yeah, she definitely pays homage to her town, for sure.
Well, it's interesting because she is now Quebecois.
No, I know.
She was born in Toronto and lived in Toronto for most of her life until she took the job with the CBC.
Oh, how interesting.
And has assumed that Quebecois inserts in a French word wherever she can in order to emphasize that we are different. Mm-hmm. We still remember.
Mm-hmm. Je me souviens.
Yeah.
And she has said as much in interviews that her adopted home she mm-hmm. just embraces, mm-hmm. and then clearly that's true from her books. I can see being tempted to visit Quebec after reading her book. She really loves it and communicates that.
Was her husband Quebecois?
I don't think I know that.
He was a medical practice at the University of Montreal or something like that. Something like that. I don't know.
Let's talk about some of the we talked about Ruth a little bit. What about Olivier and Gabri, the owners of the bistro and the B&B? So she's put these very out there gay couple in a prominent place in the town, that everything seems to happen, in fact, in their establishments for a while. So what do we think of them? Did she paint them realistically?
I thought she did.
Yeah, I think so.
I love the way they are, so beloved in the community, and their gayness is part of their persona. And so, you know, people, you know, will refer to one of them and say, oh, you old queen, or, you know,
I think acceptance was an important part of this, from the community for them, particularly since the bird crap was, you know, thrown all over their awning and people rallied around. It wasn't for them to just clean up. I mean, a lot of people got involved in that.
Well, Three Pines was also initially a haven. That was the idea of the Three Pines, is that loyalists from the colonies were always welcome there. Mm-hmm. The English loyalists during the Revolution saw the Three Pine trees. They knew they were safe there.
Mm-hmm.
And
so everyone should be safe.
A
safe haven.
It's a safe haven. Yeah.
And it also means that everyone has come to live there, has brought a backstory from someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all come from very different backgrounds and lives to come to live in this mm-hmm. quiet, perfect place.
And isn't it interesting that she describes Three Pines as somewhere that you can't really get to except by mistake?
You can't find on a map.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of fairy tale-ness about
it. Yeah, like Shangri-La.
I think if she's written Gamache as an ideal man, maybe over-idealized, Reine Marie is like the perfect wife, at least in the books that I've read.
Yeah.
And he can share everything with her. She's enormously supportive. She falls in love with Three Pines. She likes to go visit there. Everybody loves her when they meet her. So she's a pretty perfect wife to a pretty perfect husband, it seems like.
And it comes out later in subsequent books that she's also has been a prominent librarian, I think, in the mm-hmm. National Library. So she's very well educated and well known in her own field. So she's not just making dinner for every you know, waif that comes through.
And yet they raised a son who was troubled.
Daniel.
I think. Drug problems. And
yeah, and I think that, well, it does come out later where some of that tension comes from, but I will not be a spoiler.
Okay. Yeah, I should. You're saying there's always something.
Right. And, and even that perfect families have their own issues. You know?
Clara and Peter are an interesting couple of characters. Also, both artists. As you mentioned earlier, Peter, at least early in the series, I don't know if it changes, they're pretty broke most of the time. He's the successful artist, but she's the bolder, more courageous artist who... I've read several books where she's on the brink of being discovered and recognized. I don't know if she ever really gets discovered and recognized, but you got to read more than six books for her to finally
yeah,
make it.
And it's interesting that, I don't think this is a spoiler, but that one of the paintings that makes her famous in the end is a painting that she did of Ruth as the Virgin Mary. And that she painted in such a way that the ordinary person looking at it sees just despair. But there's a little bit of light in one of her eyes that makes others know it's a hopeful painting.
Yes. Yes. I love the I did read about that and I love the description of that. I'm glad she finally gets recognized for that, but yeah, so that's an interesting couple. And even though, well, Peter is a successful artist, his works are more
commercial.
Well, I was going to say popular. Mechanical kind of. I mean, he's got a shtick. He focuses in like a microscope on one little thing, and then paints it in very realistic detail. And he's the one that's making any of the money in the family for the couple.
I believe it's $11,000 a year.
Yeah.
She's making $1,000 a year.
And yet their friends come over for soup and wine all the time. So
but they bring food.
They bring food. Yeah.
And they bring the wine.
This book that I read focuses on them, the couple, and a lot of discussion contrasting and comparing their art styles. And in this book, it is Clara that is getting more recognition and Peter kind of losing his way with his art and the clinical antiseptic versus the feeling emotional. And one might be technically proficient, but you walk away and you're not remembering it, where the other one might be messy, but it just raises emotion. So it was a lot of art discussion in this. So
yes,
if that was of interest to you, you're going to like this.
Oh, good. I'm going to keep going.
Just thinking of some of the descriptions of Clara where Peter reaches over and pulls a little rigatoni out of her hair.
Yeah, I know.
I can relate.
Or there was a pastry that was smashed on her face.
Yeah. It's sort of an artist kind of stereotype, isn't it?
Also, that partnership of two artists is explored in different ways in different books, and how Peter's feelings change as she gets more recognition, and has been interesting in what I've read so far, and I'm sure will be come back again as her status in the art world changes, because it's a little threatening, but you know, when you always thought you were the successful artist in the family, and
you see that in Hollywood couples a lot, right, where they're two stars who are married and one suddenly takes off, and it's got to be tough.
Oh, yeah.
One thing about Peter is that he came from a prosperous family in Montreal, And to their dismay, he chose to be an artist rather mm-hmm. than follow the business world or something else that they were in. Mm-hmm. So he made his choice and is paying the price for it, mm-hmm. so to speak. Mm-hmm. But if it gives them joy, then
right.
that's
I didn't catch that. Yeah. And Clara came from
modest background.
But there's an interesting thing there, just that you brought up, Peter, is that Peter gave up his opulent life for his art. Mm. We were just trashing his art.
Yeah. Poor guy. Can't win, huh?
Well, he probably could have done better in the, you know, the financial part.
Yes.
If he didn't labor over each thing so long.
Mm. Yeah.
Which maybe modified his style, but that was a choice he's made.
Right.
That's what he felt he had to do.
True to himself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Stacy, whatever happened with Nicole? She was in the first book. Not the last.
You know what? It's been so long since I read those first books, I don't even remember. So many, as Carol said, so many police officers have come and go mm-hmm. that I will say that I don't remember much about her after the first book or two.
She's in a couple books, then you don't hear about her, and then, oh, well, look at who's back again. Back again in number six.
She's so unpleasant, and yet I feel a little bad for her because mm-hmm. her home life is, yeah.
Well, she's trying so hard. She's trying so hard.
Yeah.
Right, and you know, he seems to have a certain affinity for people who are really mm-hmm. not friendly, not smooth, rough, hostile even in the Grey Wolf and the books, two or three books leading up to that, the recruit who is just so difficult.
Myrna serves an interesting role as she's the bookstore owner, so she makes lots of great literary references to things, but also she's a retired psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you want to debate motivation and background and things like that, she serves a nice purpose there. And but I hope she doesn't murder anybody because I like her character. I always feel like she's when she puts her two cents in, I listen.
She's solid.
Yeah. So I can see how you enjoy revisiting your friends, Stacy, when you go mm-hmm. back to these books.
Yeah, now I want to go back and read them all from the beginning so I can remember Nicole and. Yeah. What happens to her.
Yeah. And I encourage you to try listening to one of them.
Yeah.
I really think the audible is very good.
I loved listening to a couple of them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think she writes about one a year. She was a broadcaster first and started writing at about age 40 she first got published at around age 40. She was probably writing long before that. But she said it was quite a transition from broadcast journalism to writing because on I think it was TV, she was always had to pare things down and just give the facts. And to have to write description and describe what the scene was and what people looked like and how they felt, those are all not part of journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And when she first got published, she was astonished and thrilled. And if she dared hope to write more than one book, she thought she'd write four because she wanted to share life in that part of Quebec, with the Eastern Townships, is that what mm-hmm. they call it?
Yes.
In the four seasons.
Oh,
and so
mm-hmm.
they're not all in winter, Peter. You get the black flies sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
But, she wanted to write those four books, but she really seems as surprised as anybody with the success that she's had. I think it's 19 now that she's written, and it's about one a year.
I did read that she figured out pretty early on that she couldn't have them all be in Three Pines because the whole town would be dead or else in jail. So she tries to at least make every other one somewhere farther afield. Because I know there's one in the monastery, and I think, you know, a couple mm-hmm. in Montreal or in various places. I think one takes place on an Indian or Native American reservation, just that she has to be a little more far-flung.
Well, my friend has a T-shirt. You know, on PBS, they have Midsummer Murder.
Midsummer Murder.
And her T-shirt says, Midsummer, population 2000 crossed out, population 1099 crossed out, population. And then the population numbers get smaller and smaller and smaller. And this little town in England, they're dying like flies. So. Yes, you've got to be careful when you've got your wonderful little set of characters. You don't want them all to be murderers or victims.
Right.
Also, that big scary house on the hill comes back in different ways in different books too, and that's interesting to see. Now that I've read some of her books, I realize that this extraneous character that they brought in that seemed to be a red herring, so to speak, you know, I'm going to keep my eye on him because I bet he's back again next time or in the next couple of times. So, anyway.
I
go ahead, Peter.
Okay. Yolanda was perplexing to me also. You know, she's rash. She's kind of the pejorative of what some people think realtors are. But I didn't quite understand, since she felt that the house, Timmer's house, was going to be, Jane's house was going to be hers. And then she goes in and papers over all of that.
Yeah,
and
that
I couldn't
was odd.
Really understand the motivation. What? Why was
if
that?
If she was going to sell it, wouldn't she just paint over it with white paint or something?
Yeah. That seemed weird to me, too.
Yeah. That didn't make any sense. Yeah. Unless she was just acting out some kind of anger or something.
Yeah.
But still, if she's going to sell the house, she's a realtor. She knows about property value, right? Mm-hmm. No one's going to buy something that weird. So,
but she deliberately chose ugly wallpaper.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I was talking about characters, I didn't mean to skip over Jean-Guy Beauvoir, the Gamache's second in command. And they serve as a nice point counterpoint for each other. Mm-hmm. Gamache is all about the emotions and feelings and so on that go into the motivation for murder, whereas Jean-Guy is all about the facts and he likes to write things with a marker on the big board and get all the facts down. And but he's very good at investigating a crime scene or doing investigations into people's backgrounds. And so the two of them work well together. And you see a real fondness developing between both, and it's mutual, the real fondness there. And that's nice to see.
Spoiler alert, they merge together in the Grey Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
Jean-Guy has married Gamache's daughter.
Oh, wonderful. Good. Good.
When I was trying to select this book, I opened up the front page just to glance at some of the reviews, and one of the reviews landed me through a rabbit hole. she described, she does all this with beautiful writing and occasional literary flourishes. And I said, literary flourishes, you know, what defines fiction versus literary fiction? So it just made me like, what, you know, that is elevated, I'm assuming, if something is literature versus merely fiction. So I just thought it was interesting, like, what aspects of her writing would vault it into that literary category.
Well, I think in Still Life, that whole scene where the women have the burning thing. Oh, and that's a tradition.
That ritual.
That ritual. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a very colorful thing. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you could almost smell the aroma, you know, in your mind, mm-hmm. anyway. And but that was I thought that was beautifully managed.
And it may be a reference to how much poetry she includes, how many literary references she includes. So it may be referring more to the literature that's brought into the book.
Being the dorky student that I am, I had to do like a chart as to like literary fiction versus just commercial fiction.
Oh, good.
Good. More artistic expression, complex writing style, universal themes versus genre-specific, metaphorical expression versus direct language, reflective pacing.
Mm-hmm. As
in Murder Doesn't Happen Until 20 Pages Left. So I just thought it was interesting. Like, what does classify literature versus regular fiction? I get distracted and get down these rabbit holes sometimes, but they're happy distractions.
Yeah, so that's great. Well, you know, we don't usually do nights like this where we focus on one author, but this has been really fun. We'll have to think as we plan ahead whether there would be another author that would be well suited to this. I think that Louise Penny has given us a lot to talk about and to, you know, reflect on, because and I think that alone tells us it's a little more than cozy mysteries.
Yes.
I know that they have made some of them into television programs, but I don't know that I ever saw them.
I don't think Louise liked it very much at all.
Oh.
Oh, I don't know. There was one on PBS.
Okay.
It just called it Three Pines, and I think it put together like two or three of the books.
Okay.
And kind of merged them into a miniseries.
I think a great many authors resent their books being made into plays or theater.
Yeah, that they think that their own wishes will be, and their characters will be respected more than they turn out to be.
Yes.
I'm going to need to look up and see who they had playing Gamache, if he was a handsome man or who they selected.
He was described as being rather rotund and short, wasn't he?
Oh, was he short? No, I don't think he was short.
I believe he was.
Oh.
Rotund, yes, because he really does enjoy those croissants. But he's a large man.
I think he's tall, too. Yep. I think he's just tall overall. Big.
Yeah. I think it was Alfred Molina.
Oh, fun. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I think we need to pause here so we can tell people what's coming up next. I'll remind you that Speaking Volumes is broadcast on the first Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. That's the live broadcast, but it's also repeated each Sunday night at 9. If you'd like to get a monthly email reminder before each broadcast, please send an email to info@audiojournal.org. And I did remember this month to send it out. Coming up next month, April 1st, the badass librarians of Timbuktu and their race to save the world's most precious manuscripts. In May, we'll talk about True Grit by Charles Portis. In June, Challenger, a true story of heroism and disaster on the edge of space by Adam Higginbotham. As far as next month, the book, The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts by Joshua Hammer, a journalist recounts the efforts of a small group of librarians and archivists in Mali to rescue thousands of rare manuscripts before they fall into the hands of the jihadists attacking the city of Timbuktu. I've started reading this book. Allow yourself some time to read it, especially the first few chapters. If, like me, you didn't know anything about the history of Mali and Timbuktu, you'll get a big dose of it in the first few chapters, but then you can appreciate what these librarians were up against. We love hearing from our listeners. If you have book recommendations to pass along or a comment about the book we're discussing next, you can call the office at 508-752-0557, or you can email us at info@audiojournal.org. Speaking Volumes has been a production of Audio Journal. Our program has been archived and can be easily accessed by visiting our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. Thanks tonight to Susan and Steve Robsky, to Stacy Lanier, Carla McCullough, and Peter Welsh. My name's Carol Sarafkhan. I hope you'll join us next month for the Librarians of Timbuktu. Happy reading.
This is Bernal. Isla Guadalupe, off the western coast of Mexico, is famous for its massive colonies of petrels, shearwaters, and laysan albatrosses. Now, conservationists hope it will host black-footed albatrosses too, like Bruno. In 2021, Bruno was one of a dozen black-footed albatross chicks from Hawaii's Midway Atoll to Mexico. The move was part of a larger effort to establish a new black-footed albatross colony on Isla Guadalupe as rising seas threatened their native breeding grounds. On Isla Guadalupe, a research team led by marine ecologist Julio Hernandez fed the chicks by hand and placed decoys that looked like parents to help them learn to be birds. Once Bruno and the other black-footed albatrosses were old enough to fledge, they soared out to sea with the native laysan juveniles. When they started returning to the colony 2 years later, the black-footed albatrosses were a bit awkward. Some tried to woo a laysan mate, but their courtship dances were incompatible. And though Bruno socialized happily with others of his species, he didn't feel the spark with any of the eligible ladies. Until La Güera, Julio says.
Bruno's leg band is number 5, and La Güera is number 4.
She'd been his next neighbor in Hawaii and his crate mate on the flight to Mexico. Turns out, Bruno had been holding out for the girl next door.
It's a beautiful love story. I will bet anything that they will be the first couple to form, and theirs will be the first egg we get from these relocated albatrosses.
For BirdNote, I'm Shay Gisbell.
Have you listened to one of Audio Journal's most popular shows, Talking Topics, with host Bill Ruggiero? You can catch it on the second weekend of each month, airing Saturday at 3 p.m. and again on Sunday at 6 p.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal. Hello, listeners. Would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
A man left home one morning. He turned right and ran straight ahead. Then he turned left. After a while, he turned left again, running faster than ever. Then he turned left once more and decided to go home. In the distance, he could see two masked men waiting for him. Who were they?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
The man was a baseball player. The two masked men were the umpire and the other team's catcher.
And now back to our regular programming.